This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. This show is coming to you at a time of rapidly consolidating fascism in the U.S. and actually around the world. Refuse Fascism, at refusefascism.org, has announced nationwide protests beginning October 19th in New York City and Los Angeles, and then going nationwide every Saturday beginning October 26th. So, we're going to be bringing you news and will also bring you important voices because people act on what they understand. At the back end of the show, we'll be listening to Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on what we need to do now from his film, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. Before that, you'll hear an interview I did earlier this year with Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale University and the author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And right now, as promised in last week's show, we're going to hear the end of a speech by Andy Z, co-initiator of Refuse Fascism and member of the National Revolution Tour. The speech, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go Now, was given to a national meeting of Refuse Fascism.
Look, we say this is fascism not as an insult or to be better than everyone else opposed to the regime, but because that is what an objective evaluation shows. Too many, even some who write books warning of fascism, prefer to say it's authoritarian, it's proto-fascist, it's neo-fascist. Anything but to squarely confront that the Trump-Pence regime is fascist. Yes, it has not as yet consolidated a full-out fascist form of rule. If it had already done so, it would be immeasurably more difficult to do what we are planning for. But here's the important point. History shows that it can become too late to stop it without tremendous cost. And yes, it is an American fascism reasserting and recreating the founding myth of this country as a shining city on a hill, a mythology that's wrapped in the flag and the Bible taken literally, white supremacy with the male at the head of the traditional family, with the nation blessed with a divine right to rule over everything. Robert Paxton writes in his book, The Anatomy of Fascism, quote, "The language and symbols of an authentic American fascism would have to be as familiar and reassuring to loyal Americans as the language and symbols of the original fascism were familiar and reassuring to Italians and Germans." Here, too, is why the Democrats and their mouthpieces in the mainstream media have no answers but only mumbles. CNN or NBC prattle on and on about how he can't do what Trump does. That's not normal. That's not presidential. That's not how it's done. When that is precisely the point, Trump and Pence are breaking the norms to bring about a different form of rule to this country, which they and the forces behind them see as the only way to save their vision of America and its capitalist imperialist foundation. And then the Democratic Party works to confine the resistance to the very norms that the fascists, by definition and purpose, seek to tear up. So I will conclude this discussion of fascism with this, which is also from Bob Avakian, who has been identifying, as I said, and analyzing and putting forward how to deal with the development of fascism in the United States over the past several decades. In a speech in October 2017, which is that film I spoke of, "The truth, another terrible truth that must be faced, is that in the context of profound and acute contradictions that are asserting or reasserting themselves, that are tearing at the very fabric and deepening cracks in the foundation of this country, at the same time as the American empire is facing serious challenges internationally, fascism is one possible resolution of this. On the terms of this system and its ruling class, even as this is a horror for humanity." And in what is one of the most important insights of the Refuse Fascism call to action is this: we must confront the reality that the world as we have known it is being torn asunder. And this requires getting out of our comfort zones and not allowing our differences to stand in the way of rising together in an unprecedented and unrelenting struggle to confront the danger of a Trump-Pence fascist America. I just want to read the first sentence there. We must confront the reality that the world as we have known it is being torn asunder. That's something that should stay with all of us and cause reflection. But now with impeachment underway, with the sharpened contention between the ruling parties taking place, and before the 2020 primaries and election go into full throttle, now is when the struggle we are calling for is most favorable. It's not easy, but it is possible, because many can now grasp how necessary it is. It will not fall into anyone's lap. It will involve a tremendous struggle among the people who desire this regime to be gone over why and how it needs to be done. And I'm going to come to a conclusion of this talk by discussing some of what we have already and will continue to run into. An activist wrote me and declined to participate in the movement for now because he wrote, we have to respect the struggles that people are already involved in, as if refused fascism does not respect those struggles, which we do. And that he said, and that we should not say that this program of removing the Trump-Pence regime is the only thing that can stop this regime. Well, our sincere question is, well, what else will? What's your program? To which there is no answer. Many fighters for social justice will say, and quite honestly, that they are overwhelmed with what's already on their plate. We really get that. Yet we ask, what will come of every struggle for social justice when fascism is consolidated, when dissent is practically outlawed? We have pointed out before that fascism can absorb separate acts of resistance against the different fronts of their attacks. They will pull back and throw the opposition off balance, moving their agenda forward now here and now there. This is very important. Fascism can absorb separate acts of resistance against different fronts of their attacks. That's the point of the examples of the airports and the Muslim ban, as well as of child separation. As we go out to struggle with people as to why we need to do this, it should also be an invitation to one and to all to contribute their thinking and their questions and their criticisms, their creativity and their energy. And that invitation does not and will not stop when we launch this. Then it really just begins. It needs to be replicated thousands of times over by people we haven't even met yet. To drive out the regime, it cannot be protest as usual. And many of you know the drill. Assemble, speeches, march, more speeches, go home. No. What we are calling for is what you see now in Hong Kong. It is portrayed in the movie The Square about Egypt. It is the students and youth to the students, youth who took to the streets last Friday and will be in the streets next week. People have raised to us as a matter of morality that if I think this plan might not work, I am not responsible to take it. Really? Never, ever has serious social change come with a guarantee. And if one is offered, it is not a real solution. What is irresponsible is not to try. History will not judge us harshly if we try with all we've got to stop fascism and save the planet and humanity, and we don't succeed. But we do today, and we should, judge those who did not stand up in fascist Germany and in other countries when they could have and chose instead not to resist. We will not escape that judgment should we fail to act. Once again, that poem by Pastor Martin Niemöller captures the horrors that happen when you are just looking out for and saving yourself because you are not directly affected. And in the same vein, people have raised refuse fascism, tried this before and didn't succeed. So what will be different this time? For one, people have now experienced almost 3 years of this. And while many have accommodated to the regime, they have also seen and experienced what it has wrought and what it can bring. The murder of Heather Heyer by fascists in Charlottesville in the summer of 2017 has now been followed by several horrific mass murders of Jews and Latino immigrants. Two, People have been through the blue wave, the Mueller investigation, told to wait, had their hopes raised and dashed over and over and over again. And three, refused fascism has learned a few things. It's been raised also, if we do this, then maybe Trump will declare martial law, and we shouldn't provoke the beast. Let's see if we can ride it out. The writer George Prochnick, in his biography of Stefan Zweig, who was one of the most famous authors in Europe in the 1930s, he lived in Vienna, Prochnick wrote, quote, "The excruciating power of Zweig's memoir lies in the pain of looking back and seeing that there was a small window in which it was possible to act, and then discovering how suddenly and irrevocably that window can be slammed shut." But what about fear? It's been said that the greater fear should be that people will not act to stop this horror. And I've spoken already about the allure, the illusion, and the delusion of painless progress, of relying on the elections to stop what they will not. But people will raise to you concern about their job, their family, and repulsively about not tarnishing their brand. Well, first off, their brand. But yes, this regime is serious. They have said repeatedly that they see in Trump their last and their best chance to bring about a fascist agenda that they have worked on for decades. They have, as Trump has said, quote, many tough people on their side, end quote. They have been open about wanting a new civil war rather than give up. The matter is, and the questions are, do you want to live in their white supremacist, misogynist, Christian, fascist world?
No.
Do you want to inflict that on the billions of people who the U.S. demonizes and dominates?
No.
Do you want to live in a gated world where huge sections of humanity are locked out and left to drown or starve or live indefinitely in camps?
No.
Then, the question of the hour is, are you, are we, going to act now when there is a chance to do something about it? The way to break fear is to act together for what's right. That's what we are setting out to do. There is a tremendous liberating potential and a positive in what we envision. Think about what it would mean for people in this country to act in their millions to say, in the name of humanity, we refuse to live in a fascist America. Think about what that would mean to the people of the world. And when people act together and begin to throw off the chains of all the oppressive relations and thinking that keeps us caged in petty competitive bullshit of this society, and to be working with people like you and many who are not like you, all striving together to drive out a horrific fascist regime as we defy convention and endure good and bad weather, creating a situation where not only can the nightmare of the Trump-Pence regime be over, but we create a movement where dreams can soar, another world is possible, creativity is unleashed, and the impossible becomes possible. Thank you.
That was Andy Z, co-initiator of Refuse Fascism and member of the National Revolution Tour, with part two of his recent speech, "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go Now." You can see a video of the whole speech and find important announcements about upcoming protests at refusefascism.org. Once again, that's refusefascism.org. We'll take a musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. We rise.
right, welcome back. We rise. Let's never forget that, all right? We rise. Yeah, we gotta rise, all right? I am really, 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 I'm eager to get into this one. We're going to be talking with Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works. Now, Jason Stanley's parents survived the Holocaust in Germany, though millions of people did not, and he has spent the last 10 years studying fascism. He wants to scare us all, as someone said. I actually think he wants to ring the bell. And I like that Spike Lee film, Ring the Bell, and shouting to people, wake up, wake up, wake up. And he's here to talk with us about Donald Trump, the rise of fascism, what it means, and how people should be reacting. So, Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into this because I have 100 questions for you, okay?
Shoot.
Okay. You know, I saw a clip in an event you did in Chicago, and you talked there. You started with a story about your father sitting you down and telling you about the reality of America and the America First movement. And, you know, I guess actually I hadn't been studied up on all this in the America First movement and the relationship between that and what your dad was telling you and what's going on in the country today. Let's talk about that.
So we have a president who's explicitly referencing the America First movement. If you look at history, if you look at, say, Bradley Hart's recent book, Hitler's American Friends, it's got like 5 chapters, I think, in it. One of the chapters is on the America First movement. The Nazis thought the America First movement and its representative, Charles Lindbergh, its spokesperson, was their main hope in the United States. I mean, we had a very healthy fascist movement. It obviously had clear links to a homegrown movement, the Ku Klux Klan, whose ideology is very much overlaps with German fascism. And we had this long history of white supremacy, white nationalism. I mean, it's not a history, it's our present. It's something that the United States always struggles with. And Charles Lindbergh writes in the Reader's Digest that it's time to build our walls, build our ramparts high to protect the white race against the Mongol horde, against the Persian horde, the Arab horde, you know. This is a long history of racial demagoguery against non-whites, and that's what we're tapping into in the current moment.
Yeah, you know, it's very heavy because it's like there's that, what you're talking about in terms of this long history, and then there is the reality of today, which it really struck me because this, the aspect of people actually needing to know that what is the history of fascism and what it is in the U.S. and the fact that it isn't something foreign. It has a long and deep history. But the problem is that there's, you know, people don't realize even in this sense. I mean, I was one of the things that really surprised me in reading your book was you made a point that actually it's not like the U.S. is free from all this or is just following what happened in Germany and other places, but that actually
vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Germans were deeply influenced by the U.S. case. I mean, people don't understand what an outlier the United States was with its one-drop rule about that you were not white, you were black if you had one drop of blackness. As James Whitman discusses in Hitler's American Model, the Nuremberg lawyers carefully studied our anti-miscegenation laws and based the Nuremberg laws upon them, although they decided that one drop was untethered from reality and went instead with one-eighth. You're Jewish if you're one-eighth Jewish. So our racial laws were even too extreme for the National Socialists. Now, of course, time has changed, and we've fought. The story of America is the story of our struggle with white supremacy, and it's always a difficult struggle, and it's very slow movement and slipping back. Look at the PBS documentary Reconstruction. I mean, I was taught in school that Reconstruction failed. After the Civil War, they give 4 million black people to vote, and then suddenly there are black congressmen and senators and people in the state legislatures, and they panic and they remove the vote. And I was taught that was because black people couldn't self-govern. So, you know, so we have this long history, and what we're seeing with Trump is an aspect. Trump is very American, but he's also very fascist.
Yeah, we're going to get into that in a minute, because there's a couple of other things I wanted to ask you first. You know, this thing, just what you're starting to talk about, and the whole idea that, look, for me, it was really interesting in reading your book. It was, and I really recommend that people get this book. It's well worth sitting down, reading it, and rereading it, and it's Jason Stanley, How Fascism Works. You know, one of the things that really struck me there was that there really is this sort of, all the various structural problems in the U.S. and how that actually brought people forward, not in a way to actually deal with all this stuff, in a way that could actually, you know, be I don't know, whatever you would call it, digging in to try and do things in the right way and get, you know, get all this other stuff settled. It actually, you have people, the structural problems in the U.S. are bringing forward people that are turning to, helping them turning to fascism, which is really, you know, that is something I think people don't understand here.
Yeah, I mean, this is very clear in the literature on European fascism. Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism, chapter 10, is all about how fascism emerges when people become lonely, when you break down labor movements, when you break down movements that bring people together to better their lives. Then they, when they become lonely and isolated due to the deprivations of capitalism, then they turn for solace to identity movements that give them false, fake hopes of meaning. I mean, I don't think the thing about fascism is it's not good for white people. You know, it's not good for the people that it claims to be good for. As Hannah Arendt says, you know, fascism, you know, claims to advance the race, but in fact, it's just advancing the interests of those who are making these false promises. But those false what happens in these moments when people are isolated and afraid about their economic insecurity, is that they turn to, they desire to see some kind of victory. And they'll sacrifice their own well-being if they think that their enemies, the liberals, the elites, are having to be, are being humiliated and are being aggravated. So that's fascist politics. Fascist politics says, we're not going to give you anything. You're not going to get anything out of this, but what will you will get is we're going to torment the people you hate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's jump into this, the structure of fascism and why it's so dangerous. I mean, that's something I think people really need to understand pretty deeply.
Right. So my book is divided into 10 chapters. Each chapter covers a different aspect of fascist politics. And for me, you know, the United States is not governed like it's not a fascist government right now. We have elements of that with our prison industrial system, with the carceral state. But we're not a fascist country by any means. But we're talking about political tactics. Fascism is best thought of as a set of political tactics that breaks down democratic ideals. Let's begin with what democratic ideals are. Democratic ideals are liberty and equality. And both of those are based on truth. If you've been lied to, nobody thinks the people of North Korea are free. They've been lied to, so that's why they're not free. They'll vote for Dear Leader every time because they've been lied to. Liberty requires truth. Equality requires truth because truth is, speaking truth to power is how you equalize. So a democratic culture requires people to have respect for the truth because that's how you equalize. So it requires, like, if a very powerful person lies and someone says, you're lying, that very powerful person will be humiliated, and if they lie too much, they won't be able to participate in public life. If you lose that, you lose your democratic culture, because then a powerless person can't call out a powerful person. So let me start by running down quickly the 10 chapters. The first tactic is the mythic past. All of fascist tactics are based on a big lie, because that's the way to get you to detach from the truth. So the mythic past, we were once great, but we've been humiliated on the national stage. So you could see President Trump did this in the 2016 election. Obama bowed and scraped. He didn't throw American power around. He humiliated us. We're going to return to our greatness. We were once great, you know, wink, wink about when that once was. Propaganda. There's a certain kind of propaganda that is very clear in fascism when things mean they're opposite. Like, all fascist campaigns are anti-corruption campaigns. Even though the fascists themselves are more corrupt than anyone else, they tar their opponents with corruption because they say, this is useful for many reasons, but corruption means the wrong people are in charge. Chapter 3 is anti-intellectualism. You attack the press and the universities. So you should always worry when there's a systematic attack on the universities for being left-wing ideological indoctrination centers. So you attack the intellectual bastions, the press, for peddling leftism and liberalism under the guise of objectivity. You attack the universities for being like dens of Marxism and cultural Marxism. In Hungary, they just shut down the best university in Hungary, Central European University, for gender ideology and liberalism. So you always have to worry when there's a big attack on the universities and the press. Chapter 4, unreality. You float conspiracy theories. My first New York Times piece in 2011 was about birtherism, because knowing the history of fascism, that panicked me. When people, there's a way that conspiracy theories work. All the evidence against the conspiracy theories is actually treated as evidence for them. So the way the Nazis floated the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the Jews own the presses, they run the universities, they run the film and theater industry. And then when you said, when the presses refused to report on the protocols of the Elders of Zion, that was more evidence. Look, the press is not reporting that the Jews run the press. That just shows the Jews run the press. Similarly, President Trump in 2012 said, you can tell CNN is owned by Obama because they're controlled by Obama because they don't report on birtherism. So unreality, you destabilize people. So nobody knows what the truth is anymore, and they forget the truth. And they're like, I don't care about the truth. I know my guy is lying, but he's my guy. He's us. And his lies drive the other side crazy, and that's what I like. You know. So that's the fascist political sphere. It's just us versus them. Reality's irrelevant. Chapter 5 is hierarchy. You know, equality is a myth. Feminism is not seeking equality. It's seeking to take over. Black Lives Matter is not seeking equality. It's seeking to take over. Black people are seeking to take over. They don't want equality. So you represent the dominant group feels victimized. Trump supporters think the most victimized group in America are white Christians. So that goes into Chapter 6, victimhood. You have this incredible tapping of victimhood of the dominant group. The Nazis were like, the Germans are the most persecuted people in the world. We lost our empire. So you have this sense, you cultivate the sense that the persecuted people who are losing their traditions are the dominant group. And what are they victims of? Chapter 7 is law and order. They're victims of crime, of gangs, because those foreigners, and they're bringing in crime and drugs and gangs. So in Austria, Kickl, the far-right minister, he went around and told the police stations they're not allowed to talk to the mainstream press unless to report rapes of Austrian women by immigrants. So you create panicked fear about gang members and rapists, and that leads to the next chapter, which is sexual anxiety. You know, what crime do they do? Well, they do the crime of, they're rapists. We have to protect their women, our women, and that's why we need a strong leader, because the strong leader is going to build a wall and protect our women from the foreigners. And you raise panic about homosexuality. You raise panic about turning boys into girls, because it's manlyhood that's prized in fascist politics. It's patriarchy. And then, the first real fascist politics we had in recent years was Sarah Palin. So that hit the Chapter 9, Sodom and Gomorrah. The cities are the places of decadence and liberalism. That's where everyone mixes together. Chapter 2 of Mein Kampf is called Mein Time in Vienna. And he says, in Vienna, there were foreigners everywhere, foreign languages, and Jews, and more Jews. So the hated outgroup always lives in the cities. Think of what the expression inner city means in America. Cities are where black people live. It's where the immigrants live. And so you create the real Americans live in the countryside, rural versus urban divide. And Chapter 10 is called Arbeit macht frei, which was emblazoned on the gates of Auschwitz. Work shall make you free. Time and time again, the outgroup is always lazy. There are drains on the state, and you need to make them work for free in order to earn a work ethic. And that is at the heart. So that's why the idea in Nazi Germany was that Jews were lazy and never did any work. And they just got money because the government gave them, they worked in banking, and they just got money from interest and just were lazy. And you had to force them to work to give them a work ethic. And that's what is happening in our prison system right now. And then you target labor unions, because labor unions, are about, making workers' lives easier. But you need to break down labor unions, because labor unions forge connections across racial divides.
Yeah, this is incredible, actually. And let me make a quick announcement here. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jason Stanley, who is the author of the book, How Fascism Works. So let's get back into it. Now, Jason, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, and you've been hitting it some, but there's this point about why exactly this is so dangerous, because you're thinking like, okay, you go through this, you have Lindbergh, all these people,
early on talking about fascism. Fascism raises its head, you know, throughout the decades that we've been around, that we've been alive over, you know, since the 1920s all the way up, or 19 and even 1930. You have, who was it? Is it Bannon that talked about it's going to be a good year because it's a lot like 1930, something like that.
Said, he said, we're going to, in a Hollywood Reporter interview, he said it's going to be exciting like the 1930s. Yeah. Now, he's always winking. So, yeah, that's the decade he goes back to, and that's the decade where the United – now, it's tricky because Bannon has plausible deniability. He'll say, I meant the New Deal, but I'm skeptical that he meant the New Deal.
Yeah, I think you're right to be skeptical. It's sort of – yeah. But the thing is like when you that gets into this character of the fascist tactics, and, you know, it is really – there's something that you keep bringing up in your book that really struck me, that fascism seeks to replace truth by power, and that there's a very particular method to doing that. Let's talk about that.
So – the method is you get people, you try to replace, so truth balances out loyalty. If we recognize the truth, if we recognize facts, so I don't mean like a deep truth. So people think that the Russian language makes a distinction between deep truth and truth. So that's why that covers propaganda. You lie, but you lie to reveal a deeper truth. I'm talking about just facts. So the enemy of fascism is just facts, just ordinary facts. Because ordinary facts, if everyone has loyalty to ordinary facts, then, you know, it's hard to get away with stuff. They're just ordinary facts. And you have to have, a democratic culture requires that people are humiliated when they lie about ordinary facts. But what you try to do is you try to say, look, the whole system is corrupt. Everybody's lying. Think of Fox News' slogan, old slogan, fair and balanced. Everyone knew Fox News was not fair and balanced. The point of that slogan was to suggest that no one is fair and balanced, that Fox News is just as fair and balanced as everyone else, meaning not fair and balanced at all, because everyone is corrupt, everyone is lying. So you break down trust. You break down trust between citizens. So everyone is just like, okay, I don't know what's true anymore. I don't even care what's true. I just care about my guy winning, and I care about my guy winning and humiliating those liberal cosmopolitan elites and making them feel miserable. What we call owning the libs. And if you go back throughout fascist politics to the 1930s, to the German and Italian fascist movements, that's what it was about. It's about humiliating the elite. It was about bringing them down and, you know, and doing it in the service of your guy gaining power. And so it's like following sports teams. Sports is healthy because it takes away our fascist inclinations and focuses them on something it's fine to root for. It's totally fine for me to be like a total supporter of the New York Knicks because, you know, painful as it is in recent years, you know, that's my team. But that's not the attitude you want to bring to politics. The Democratic Party is not your team. The Republican Party is not your team. The truth is your team. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to raise conspiracy theories to try to humiliate the opponent, to try to just tar them with worst things ever, and just make politics into spectacle and show instead of – that's the other thing that we find. So you find Arendt talking about that all the time. She said, in fascism, people are glued to the screen. They're no longer – the news is no longer the news. The news is entertainment. The news is like, what's happening now in the ever-crazy turmoil of the administration? Who's in? Who's out? And then no one is following anymore. They get addicted to this, like, spectacle of excitement. And then – you know, instead of like the boring policy of healthy democratic give and take.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things as you're talking, I kept going back to this, where you get, you know, you talk about in the book, you talk about, you know, Hitler and value comes from victory and struggle, as you've been pointing to, but that also that if you want to get rid of political equality, you actually, this is what you do. You get rid of people's respect for the truth, which is really an interesting thing to posit.
Absolutely. The truth is much more important than people realize, and people are giving it up just to, like, own the libs far too easily. You know, Trump supporters understand he's lying constantly, but think it's cool. They think it's cool because it you know, triggers the libs. But, you know, if we all step back, Trump supporters and non-Trump supporters, and say, how about we go back to a culture where we just focus on the truth and it's not about, like, humiliating people anymore, because that's not a politics, actually. Politics should be like, here's this, you know, let's talk about a $1 wage raise. Let's talk about the weekend and how we're losing the weekend. Like, I kind of like the weekend. It took the unions a long time to get us the weekend. Let's hold on to the weekend. You know, And it, to get people back to that level and to get people back to respecting the truth, it's a humble thing. It's a little thing, but it's the center of democratic culture.
Mm-hmm. Now, you think about this. It's, you know, it's a lot of the things that you're talking about, you also go into a section in your book where you talk about that thinking of the normalcy of fascist ideology, you know, that there's a normalization of that going on, and it's very dangerous. And if you think about that, you bring up the term American exceptionalism, and it's constantly brought up generation after generation, and this is very dangerous.
Very dangerous. Very dangerous. So part two of Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism is called imperialism. M.A. Césaire in Discourse on Colonialism speaks regularly about, he says, Hitler's the worst person on earth, not because of what he did, but because of who he did it to, Europeans. He was doing to Europeans what the Belgians had done in the Congo when they killed 10 million people, like imperialism. And Hitler, of course, was infuriated, as Du Bois and The World in Africa brings out, was infuriated by the loss of the German colonies in Africa. Imperialism, the idea that the world is yours, is a very dangerous thing. So 9/11 really triggered a lot of what's happening now. Because 9/11 was, we lied ourselves, we got comfortable lying ourselves into a colonial war. We sold ourselves on we're spreading democracy. And here's the thing. I mean, Trump was very sophisticated about this, and I respect him immensely for the intelligence this took. He said, we're not good. Look at the Iraq War. So that always happens. When you become hypocritical with your colonialism, when it becomes just too obvious that you're not spreading democracy, you're in fact crushing people under your boot, then someone is going to come and say, hey, crush, that's what we do. We crush people under our boot. And that's fascism.
Mm-hmm. You know,
so
what
imperialism leads directly to fascism. The Iraq War led directly to our moment.
Boy, that's pretty heavy. Wow. Tell me this. This thing you talk about in the book about fascist inversion and ideas used to undermine themselves. And then I was thinking about that whole process actually can be used to undermine the entire society. You know, these anti-corruption campaigns, the unreality you referred to earlier. And then something that you also talk about, which we'll get into in a minute, but the victimhood that's actually been really out there now. So let's just first talk about this fascist inversion. What do you mean by that? And why is it so dangerous?
So remember there was a Saturday Night Live early on in the Trump administration where they had the Breaking Bad actor, played the Walter White character, come and as the new head of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, as a joke, you know, because Trump kept on appointing people who were the opposite of their agencies. Mick Mulvaney was running the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Everyone running, he put Rick Perry as the Secretary of Energy. I believe it's Secretary of Energy. He put people who wanted to dismantle the very agencies they were running as head of the agencies. So he was inverting everything. So fascists run. So I talk about the example. I mean, this inversion point is familiar from literature. George Orwell's 1984, War is Peace. So think about, do you know what the name of Guantanamo Bay is? Camp Justice. Mm. So this inversion where you represent things as their opposite. So how was Trump able to run an anti-corruption campaign? I mean, the New York Times investigation revealed the depths of his corruption, of his business corruption. So how is he able to run this anti-corruption campaign? Well, he's able to run it by painting the system as corrupt and rigged. And to be honest, the system had a lot of was pretty corrupt and rigged. But that's very dangerous when that happens. When you can paint the system as corrupt and rigged, then you can run. Then the corrupt candidate becomes like the authentic candidate. He's the one who's openly corrupt, and everyone's like, well, he's obvious. He's not hiding anything. He's openly corrupt. And so they can be the anti-corruption candidate. But it's a joke. Then they run and then they go into office. He's representing the little man. He has a $1.5 trillion tax cut for the oligarchs that fund him and himself. So everything means it's opposite, but it's fine because he's triggering the lips.
Mm-hmm. Boy. All right. I have a couple more questions here for you. And when we're talking about this, and you know, it's part of this thing of, I don't know, it's sort of like the you know, you've just been talking about a little the politics of pollution and corruption. But there's another thing that actually sticks out really, really sharply in relation to Trump and fascism and the situation of people in this country and in the world right now. And in particular, I was really intrigued by this thing of Trump and young black men who, by their existence, their very existence, are violations of law and order, labeled rapists or whatever. Young black men are targets under this fascist stuff.
Right. So things don't mean, under fascism, things mean their opposite. They don't mean, so law and order doesn't mean law and order. So as I talk about in the book, when Jeff Sessions in November 2016 said, you can tell from Trump's response to the Central Park 5 case that he's going to be a law and order president. What was meant by that? The Central Park Five were five completely innocent young black men who were arrested for a crime they did not commit, and every possible, there was no physical evidence connecting them to the crime. There was the sperm found there was later shown to be the sperm of a convicted rapist who was on a spree at the time. So they were completely innocent, and they got a settlement from New York City, and Trump said, no, they're guilty. New York City shouldn't have paid the settlement. So what does it mean that Sessions said, oh, he's a law and order president? Law and order is punishing, is making sure that people who are guilty for the crimes face, that society is protected from them, and we do something about that situation. It doesn't mean punishing the innocent for crimes they didn't do. Well, law and order under fascist politics means the out-group, the young Hispanic men, young black men, they are, by their very nature, violations of law and order. They're criminals. The Nazis, too, painted the German Jews as criminals. When the Nazis ran, they said, we're going to imprison all the criminal Jews. And many Jewish people said, okay, they're not going after me. But it turned out they meant people with traffic tickets, speeding tickets, exactly what's happening with immigrants right now. Mm.
All right, one last question, and this is one that actually I think it's imperative for people to pay attention to. It's the chapter Arbeit macht frei. And I wanted to ask you about that because it's actually something that I think in some ways brings together everything that you've just been talking about. So let's get into that.
So Arbeit macht frei is about the fact, so fascism is based on social Darwinism. So social Darwinism is the view that value goes with whoever, with the winner. There's winners, and you always got to, people are channeling social Darwinism when you have politicians talking about winners and losers. If you hear a politician talking about, well, there's winners and there's losers, and I don't like the loser, that's social Darwinism. That's the idea that value only goes with the winners. If you want a good, handy mnemonic to realize how bad that is and how dangerous it is, think of the Nazi T4 program, where they gassed the disabled. Why did they gas the disabled? Because the Nazis held they had no value because they couldn't do hard work. So they couldn't fight in a competitive market. So social Darwinism is at the core of Nazism. Now, fascism is not social Darwinism of the individual. So economic libertarianism is social Darwinism of the individual. It, too, I believe, is a dangerous doctrine, but it's an acceptable doctrine to have in a free society. You know, libertarians are anti-fascists because they restrict their social Darwinism to the individual. Fascists say certain groups have more value than other groups. Americans have more value than non-Americans. Whites have more values than blacks. Jews have more values than Palestinians. That's the sort of social Darwinism of the group that you find in fascist thinking. And the idea is, and then there's this fiction that there's this hierarchy of value that's been created by hard work. The in-group, the German ideology was that Germans were hard workers, and they worked hard, and Jews were lazy, and they lived off interest and banking, and so you had to force them to do free labor. Because you can distinguish the valuable group, because they're hard workers, from the lazy people. And the lazy people have lesser value. And that's the structure of the hierarchy. The lazy people are rapists and criminals, and they're lazy. The valuable people are hard workers and law-abiding. And that's how you construct the value. And labor unions, they try to make it easier. And we don't want to make the workers' lives easier, because hard work gives you value. Now, in fact, hard work is not at the center of liberalism. Like, it's not the case that you have value because you're better at working longer hours. You have value in liberalism because you are a human being worthy of dignity.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jason. Anything you'd like to add before we leave?
No, I think that's how fascism works covers it, and you've done a great job of asking about its themes.
Thank you, man. I really think people should get this book, check it out, read it, pass it around. Very important, especially in this time that we're living in. So, Jason Stanley, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Michael.
All right, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works. Jason Stanley's parents survived the Holocaust in Germany, though millions did not. He has spent the last 10 years studying fascism, and he's produced an incredibly important book that people should definitely check out. That was International Noise Conspiracy with Let's Make History Tonight. Now, for a further understanding of the fascism of the Trump-Pence regime, its roots in the history of this country, and why it's come to the fore at this time, there's an unparalleled resource in this talk by Bob Avakian, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. And I also want to play a clip from Bob Avakian and another talk about why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. So check this out.
So let's get deeper into what we need to do now. Let's go back to the crucial point that we need to be serious and scientific. A scientific approach and method leads to the understanding that the basis for revolution lies not in what most people are thinking or doing right now, or at any given time, but in the deep and defining contradictions of this system, what is concentrated in the five stops and all the terrible suffering to which this system subjects millions and billions of people, which cannot be eliminated within this system. But this revolution will not be brought about magically or just by the way this system causes people to suffer. This revolution must be consciously and systematically built for, from here forward, with ever-growing numbers of people, first in the thousands and ultimately in the millions, who are brought forward into the organized ranks of the revolution to actively work for this revolution. How we can win lays out the plan and the means for how we can make this real. First, it is important to understand that although it is true, as I have said in the New Communism, that revolution cannot and will not be made just by spreading the idea of revolution around and perhaps getting some positive responses, thumbs up. At the same time, however, it is also true that spreading the word about this revolution can itself be very important revolutionary work, an important part of building the movement for revolution. The fact is that among those who really need to know about this, including those who most desperately need this revolution, very few have even heard about it. And they are living with the belief that this world as it is the only one that's possible. And for many, this means that on top of being subjected to continual brutality, degradation and torment, they are suffocated by the lack of hope. Raising people's sights to the possibility of a radically different world can not only bring hope to people on a scientific basis, but can also awaken a potentially powerful force for the revolution that could make this hope a reality. For these reasons, we need to be on a mission to spread the word, to let people know that we have the leadership, the science, the strategy and program, and the basis for organizing people for an actual emancipating revolution. Here again is the importance of the point I emphasized earlier about the great strengths we do have and what is still missing: masses of people who catch the worst hell under this system, and those who were sickened by the endless outrages perpetrated by this system, who need to be brought forward wave after wave and develop into conscious revolutionaries and revolutionary leaders. Spreading the word, particularly as this is done together with others in a planned, systematic way, can be an important step in joining the organized ranks of the revolution and taking part in the process of building the revolution. A crucial next step in making this revolution real is that thousands need to get organized into the ranks of the revolution now, while millions are being influenced in favor of this revolution. Getting organized into the ranks of the revolution means acting together with others in a unified way, as an organized force, guided by the strategic plan and leadership for the revolution, building the revolution among broader masses of people, while also getting deeper into the principles, methods, and goals of this revolution, the basics of which are concentrated in the points of attention for the revolution. A key form of revolutionary organization are the revolution clubs, which live by, propagate, and fight for those points of attention. The core of the revolution clubs are people deeply committed to revolution who closely follow the leadership of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which has the basis in the new communism to provide overall leadership for the revolution. But the revolution clubs also need to reach out to and involve growing numbers of people who are new to the revolution. The revolution clubs are a means through which people can take part in and powerfully represent for the revolution in an organized way as they learn more about the revolution and advance toward joining the party. Networks of people working together to spread the word about and organize people into the revolution need to be built and expanded in all parts of the country and linked together. In areas where the party and the revolution clubs have not yet established an organized presence, or in circumstances where people have not yet come into direct contact with this organized presence of the revolution, but have become aware of the core principles and goals of the revolution, they should reach out to and involve others they can draw forward around those core principles and goals. They should link up with the central leadership of the revolution for assistance and direction in organizing a revolution club among the people they are bringing into the revolution on the basis of the points of attention for the revolution, which are included in the pamphlet, How We Can Win, and are posted at revcom.us. A crucial connecting link in all this is the party's website, revcom.us, and newspaper, Revolution, which sharply expose the crimes of this system, scientifically analyze why it cannot be reformed, and give guidance and direction for people to work in a unified way for the revolution. In everything we do, it needs to be kept clearly in mind and boldly put forward to people that whatever part of the country we are in, and whatever the size of our forces at any given time, we are doing all this as part of a national movement, together with people in other parts of the country, aiming to impact all of society and building a revolution to overthrow the whole system with the whole world in mind. An important principle and method in organizing people into the revolution is the understanding that while revolution requires serious commitment, people's level of commitment will, at any given time, essentially correspond to and be grounded in what aspirations have been awakened or brought forward in them, and what they are coming to understand is required in relation to that. And this commitment should proceed from what people themselves have been won, yes, through struggle, even at times sharp struggle, to see as a necessary and essential contribution to the revolution. People can start with basic tasks that they can readily carry out and feel confident doing, which make a real contribution to building the revolution. And they can learn to take on more responsibility as they gain more experience and a deeper understanding. The important thing is that they are part of the process of building the revolution together with others. These principles and methods should be kept clearly in mind and applied at all stages of people's involvement with the revolution to enable them to continue in advancing in understanding and commitment.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on what we need to do now from his recent talk, Why We Need an Actual Revolution, and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of the people who worked on this show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going to go out now with Leon Parker and Awakening, which we all need to do.